Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 275, Pilgrim's Rest, French Bob's Gold Reef and Barberton's Champagne Footbaths. Thousands of miners were streaming into the Transvaal by the third quarter of the 19th century, a horde of avuncular independent mined treasure hunters. In Volume 2 of the Cambridge History of South Africa, Stanley Trepido calls them the ragbag of humanity. Stanley, who sadly is no longer with us, had the right to call miners whatever he wanted, having worked in Krugersdorp gold mines in order to pay for his history degree at Wits University. But I'm sure the so-called ragbags and their moms would have taken offence. It is true that anarchy of a legendary level prevailed in many of the diggings, as it had in Griqualand West. These mining pioneers, however, were far more complex than a mob. The diamond fields of Kimberley were in the hands of large corporations by the early 1880s. Men like J.B. Robinson, Cecil John Rhodes, Barney Bonatto dominated Kimberley as the whole descended towards Hades. Huge piles of capital were now required to buy equipment, to pump out the water for the steam-driven mineheads, to pay the labour. A degree of cooperation was needed, which the disparate groups of international diggers lacked. New economic organisations flourished. Consolidation was taking place. Financial collaboration secured sales usually to diamond buyers in the City of London. That needed connections, engineering skills at the pit, managerial and administrative nous. The early diggers, hardened, bearded men who scratched at surface rock, these Americans and Australians, Canadians, Russians, French, Germans, Swiss, Austrians, Norwegians, Swedes, Italians, Scots, these men and some women were imbued with the streaks of obsession of the age. They no longer fitted the economy of Kimberley. The big-name financiers were in charge. Most of these expats were fearful of blacks. Some, such as the Americans, brought a fierce view of slavery into the mining fields. They were the most vocal when it came to demands to restrict black people from owning mines and enforcing a curfew around Kimberley. Their sentiment rubbed off on those around them. These mine compounds for blacks were going to be replicated in Johannesburg. The days of the small-scale scrabbler, however, were gone. So it was with glee that many heard tales of a trove of gold that had been discovered far to the northeast in the eastern Transvaal in the early years of the 1870s. The very word gold sent shivers of anticipation through the rags of bags and the adventurers who had the guts to tramp off or ride off into the sunrise. We're returning to the early 1870s, where we'll travel with a few of these pioneering prospectors who had been infected with gold rather than diamond fever and searched high and low through the Transvaal for their precious. Wild animals gobbled some up. Many succumbed to tsetse fly and malaria. A few were murdered. Others were thrown into Transvaal jails for drunkenness and debauchery. Things looked particularly bleak until Lady Luck beamed down on a Scotsman in 1873. Tom McLachlan has been almost forgotten, but it was he who set off the gold rush in South Africa. I had a Scots aunt, or great aunt, and the more I read about Tom McLachlan, the more like Aunt Betty McLennan he sounded, particularly when it came to energy, focus, and pure guts. Possessed of an almost maniacally steadfast faith that gold lay in the eastern Transvaal hills, McLachlan prodded the rock there for years, spurred on by faith and the prospect of a £500 reward for finding gold. That was being offered by the Landdrost of Lydenburg, A.F. Janssen. McLachlan and his two partners, George Parsons and Sidney Valentine, toiled throughout 1872, prospecting the entire country north, east, and south of the Marshburg Mountain, named after geologist Karl Mausch, who predicted gold lay in them thar hills. Their sweat and toil paid off in the first weeks of 1873. They discovered what appeared to be payable gold in a stream on the north side of Spitzkop Hill, 6 hours' ride east of Lydenburg. A 2.5 ounce sample of gold was sent to Janssen, along with a request for the £500 reward. Janssen was excited and galloped off to Spitzkop Hill, along with four labourers, to test the alluvial gravel. After a few more days, they sifted out 4 ounces of pure gold. Janssen was convinced of its value and wrote a letter to the Volksraad Executive Council in Pretoria to report his findings. Then the Transvaal Volksraad broke its promise, saying there wasn't enough gold to be payable, much to McLachlan's fury. Still, Janssen warned that a large crowd of people can be expected at any moment from Natal and elsewhere. I think it advisable that the government should take action of some sort. He was right. Word spread. By the time the story had lapped on the shores of the Cape and Natal, not to mention Kimberley, the finding had turned into exaggerated tales of large nuggets lying in rivers, ready to be picked up like grapefruit. Raging gold influenza broke out. By May 1873, 100 diggers from Natal and the Cape, along with Californian and Australian expats and a sprinkling of Germans and Scotsmen, were digging and sluicing along the Spitzkop River and making a reasonable living. There was indeed gold in the Eastern Transvaal, just not a vast amount so far. As the tumble-down shacks were put up, McLachlan got the zig, as my dad would say, and left to search further north. Got the zig, by the way, is London slang, apparently, for someone in a bad mood. McLachlan bought the farm Geelhout Boom, yellow wood tree, which is ironic considering his lust for the yellow metal. That was 30 kilometres north of Spitzkop, and Lady Luck cracked another smile on the Scot, more like a massive grin this time, because he could hardly have made a wiser investment. He uncovered rich alluvial gold in the stream that ran through Geelhout Boom Plas, and here there were actual nuggets as well as specks of the gleaming yellow preciousness. No exaggerations. Much of this information is in a book written by Jade Davenport called Digging Deep, full of mind-boggling stories and facts. Other tomes worth scrutinizing with an intense scrut are Stefan Kanfer's Last Empire and William Story's The Colonialist about Cecil John Rhodes. McLachlan was soon joined on his farm by more than 200 diggers pegging claims along a 4 kilometre stretch of Geelhout Boom stream. Money was being made, no question. Personal letters from some of the diggers speak of sieving 500 and 700 pounds worth of gold. "Some reap a larger harvest than others, but none need starve," wrote one. There was virtually no black labour. The diggers had to do the hard yards themselves, and hard it was. Rocky ground. First, they'd have to remove up to 20 feet of topsoil littered with boulders, levering these out with picks, dumping them on the corner of their claims. They then redirect the stream to flow through the centre of their claim, where they set up a sluice box, about 2 feet wide, 20 foot in length. At the bottom was the Venetian ripple, rocks or wood at an angle of 35 degrees. The soil, or alluvium, to be strictly accurate, would be shoveled into the water flowing through the sluice box. The gold would sink to the bottom, and the Venetian ripples hold it in place. When the gold was particularly fine, blankets would be laid at the bottom of the box to catch the dust. Soon, down on their luck diggers, rolled in from Griqualand West and the wild frontier which made up the Eastern Transvaal, became even wilder. Diggers' committees were established to ensure law and order. The men dominating these committees were Americans and the Australians. They had brought a firm belief in digger democracy. You'd call them libertarians. As with Kimberley in the early days, no digger could own more than 4 claims, restricted to 150 square Cape feet, 47 square metres. Each licence cost 5 shillings per claim per month, and if a claim was not worked, it could be jumped by another digger. A gold commissioner was elected by the diggers, Major William MacDonald, the quintessential American, a cigar permanently clamped between his teeth, a fair but amicable man, like Stafford Parker, who you heard about in a previous episode. Soon Major MacDonald was administering a community of more than 1,000 diggers. Monitoring this influx was new Transvaal President Thomas Francois Burgers. Unlike many of his brethren, he was not averse to this flood of ragbags, despite mutterings from the folk, who said a scourge had been sent by God. Burgers took an alternative view. He eyed the Transvaal fiscus, which was constantly on the verge of bankruptcy, and decided to visit Geelhout Boom himself in 1873. Burgers, being a worldly man, he was educated in Holland, married to a Scotswoman, Nochal, was well regarded by the diggers, and they were amenable to some control. He approved MacDonald as the commissioner in all the rules that the committee had drawn up. When he was shown the role of licensed diggers, Burgers exclaimed, "Why, it's all Macs!" And indeed, there were many. MacLeod, McLachlan, MacDonald, MacPherson, MacTavish, MacLennan, MacNamara. President Burgers named the mining camp Mac Mac, and it remains Mac Mac to this day. This Scots link is important. In 1864, over 100 Scots immigrants had settled in the Transvaal as part of the McCorkendale Land Settlement. This, often called the New Scotland Project, was one of the most ambitious and ultimately tragic immigration schemes in 19th century South Africa. McCorkendale's entire business model was based on the idea that the Maputo River could be used to transport goods from the Transvaal to the sea, bypassing the expensive and arduous ox wagon routes to Natal. But the river was treacherous, filled with hippos and crocodiles, and most importantly, blocked by the Lebombo Mountains and massive silt deposits. McCorkendale died of fever in 1871 while on an island in Delagoa Bay, trying to prove the river was navigable. He died before seeing his dream realized, leaving his settlers stranded in a remote highland wilderness with no easy way to export their produce. Their commercial farms failed at precisely the point that gold was discovered, so they hurried eastwards. And they say the Irish have luck. It was called the New Caledonia Goldfield, with all the Caledonians involved. It made sense. Caledonia is part of the Scots Highlands, which the Romans never conquered. Dominated, wrote Caesar, by fierce warriors with red hair and large limbs. It is the spirit of wildness and poetic and rugged. Very apt description for the remarkable mountains of what is now Mpumalanga. The earlier diggers here made a mint, the rest not so much. A great number eventually left, destitute, heartbroken, bitter about Mac Mac. It was another Scot, Wheelbarrow Alec, who was one of these. Alec Patterson was called Wheelbarrow Alec because he pushed all his worldly possessions around in a battered wheelbarrow. Patterson, a.k.a. Wheelbarrow Alec, announced he was off and wheeled his squeaky barrow away in a northwesterly direction. Soon he reached a mountain that rose 2,000 feet. He dragged his barrow over the summit and descended into a picturesque valley watered by a 7-kilometer-long stream which zigzagged before flowing into the Blader River. In the valley was the farm Pony's Krantz, owned by Henry Steuben, which was a coincidence because it was going to be Henry Steuben who would become globally famous 10 years later as one of the discoverers of gold on the Witwatersrand. Patterson began panning the little river, and voila! Gold. Lots of it. Transvaal's gold law stipulated that every discovery and claim had to be registered with the nearest mining commissioner, which was the American Scotsman, MacDonald, back at Macmac. But Wheelbarrow Alec wanted more time to pan a fortune before the hoard inevitably rocked up. Problem was, a couple of days later, William Trafford appeared. He'd made the trip from the Macmac diggings and set to work with his sluices, and soon, goes the story, he lifted his head from his dig and cried out, "The Pilgrim is at rest," or something to that effect. And thus the name of the location, Pilgrim's Rest. Patterson and Trafford pitched their tents on the Malmani subgroup Dolomites, containing 14 gold-bearing quartz reefs, which had weathered down over millions of years, the nuggets and the particles and dust flowing into ancient streams and then concentrating in the soil of the valley. Trafford rushed back to Macmac to register his claims with Major MacDonald. Then news spread like a coronavirus. 200 prospectors descended on Steuben's farm. Eventually 4,000 claims were pegged. The goldfields here were a tough place, wild lands. Transporting food and other goods there was arduous. Ox wagons made their way up and down the rugged and steep mountains. Accidents were plenty. The food shortages grew. Fires were rained out. The diggers got their gold, but eating that metal brings very little physical comfort. Dysentery broke out. Diggers' tents were dotted along the river. Some pitched at the bottom of claims 200 feet deep. Others perched above. "An incongruous mess of canvas, boulders, dirt and water," wrote Mrs. MacDonald, one of the pioneering women to arrive at Pilgrim's Rest. Many new arrivals carried more malaria with them, staggering in from the lowveld, and yet on they went, pursuing their treasures like men possessed. Astonishing finds were logged. The Breeder and Perseverance nuggets, for example, 214 and 119 ounces respectively. By June 1874, Pilgrim's Rest had a couple of thousand inhabitants, and it was said that nearly every major language on earth was spoken. Soldiers and sailors, storekeepers, bank clerks, barmen, remittance men, gentlemen, adventurers, they all rocked up. The names of some are colourful indeed. Shovel names, they were called. French Bob, Sailor Harry, German George, Charlie the Reefer, Wally the Soldier, American Knox, Spanish Joe, Yankee Dan. And the number of black workers grew, but most claims were still worked by these white diggers themselves, until the Kimberley diggers rocked up, and these miners hated manual labour. It was they who encouraged the local Bapedi people to trek to Pilgrim's Rest. 600 black workers arrived. Then black women were brought in from Mozambique, who were hired first as housekeepers, but rapidly realised there was far more money to be made from the oldest profession, as it's known. A new people emerged from the melee, a growing population of mixed-race children. Pilgrim's Rest was developing its own nation. There were 18 pubs and canteens. The Spotted Dog was one, owned by Herbert Rhodes, Cecil's brother, who, as you know, would die in a catastrophic fire shortly. By 1875, the Pilgrim's Rest, Natal Bank and Cape Commercial Bank exported more than £1.5 million worth of gold extracted in 2 years. The men lived and died, sifting their way through millions of kilograms of dirt, and it is said that of the thousands who passed through, only 20 left the valley with a fortune big enough to keep them in comfort for the rest of their days. Monitoring all of this from a distance was President Burgers, who realized it was not the cash cow he had hoped for. Government received a paltry £2,200 in tax. That was the fee paid by miners for their claims. The gold itself melted away, exported by banks and smuggled across the border. The only material value were 837 gold coins commissioned by Burgers in a vain attempt to improve the Republic's currency. The Sikukuni Wars interrupted this treasure hunt. Then, unfortunately for the Pilgrimites, the British annexed the Transvaal in 1877. Ongoing wars between the Bapedi and the Boers and the British made life dangerous. Supplies dried up. The Anglo-Boer War of 1881 exacerbated matters, and El Dorado appeared to be closing down. Spitzkop, Macmac, Pilgrim's Rest, the New Caledonia goldfield, went through a ghostly period. Things had collapsed, and it was also to blame on Transvaal resident High Commissioner, our old friend Theophilus Shepston. He had appointed a completely incompetent surveyor called Alfred Watson Armfield as the inspector of the goldfields, who immediately disappeared into the central Transvaal searching for gold instead of signing off on claims in the east. It was only when the Transvaal was ceded back to the Boers after the First Anglo-Boer War ended that diggers could resume prospecting. In mid-1882, rich patches of alluvial gold were discovered on a farm called Berlin, high up on the summit of the Gondwan Ridge, overlooking the scenic Kaap Valley. Kaap in the eastern Transvaal, just for clarification. The large ridge looked like Table Mountain overlooking the fever-infested Lowveld. 250 diggers rushed up the mountain, then 900, most from the New Caledonia goldfields, some from Kimberley. The camp was perched on the edge of the deep valley. It built up a sinister reputation called Devil's Kantoor, Devil's Reception. Only later would a more optimistic group rename it Kaapse Hoop. Just for clarification, Kantoor in that period's Dutch meant a place where business was transacted, the Devil's Counting House, rather than just simply an office. Burger's government then granted a concession for the sole working rights of the farm to two well-known and connected Middelburg storekeepers, Charles and Benjamin Barrett. Hundreds of diggers were evicted as the Barrett's Berlin Company went to work. A hardy few took the fatal decision to descend into the valley, where the inevitable fever awaited, proving the American saying that if gold was found on the red-hot ramparts of hell, men would still seek it. It was about this time that French Bob, whose real name was Auguste Robert, and two others made their way down into the valley and avoided death by fever. In early 1883, they stumbled on gold in a tributary of the Enguiniana River. Once again, hundreds of diggers descended and named it Jamestown, a morass of tents and humanity, infested with tsetse fly, malaria, dysentery. By this stage, men were scattered like ants for hundreds of kilometers across spurs and the hills, the cliffs, disturbing the ancient grey lichens that hid gold, trying to avoid the leopards along the heights, while the Boer farmers on the hills shook their heads over the ignorant souls in the miasmal valleys. Also watching was local landowner George Pigott Moody, who owned a vast block of 13 farms, a gift for survey work he'd completed for the Transvaal government in the mid-1870s. He offered a reward for anyone who discovered gold on his land, and French Bob decided he'd had enough of Jamestown's deprivations. He and the two others I mentioned earlier, Ingram James and Magnus Jeffries, investigated the entire length of the Kaap Valley, and they found gold. But there wasn't enough water to work the finds. On one spot in particular, French Bob was sanguine about the chances of loot. It was known as Sheba Hill, as in the Queen of Sheba, who ruled over the biblical city of Ophir. More about that in a minute. In June 1883, the Queen's namesake blessed these three mines. They found alluvial gold in Concessions Creek, or Moody's estate, southwest of Barberton. French Bob followed the traces up the creek and, lo and behold, discovered Pioneer Reef. This quartz reef was half a meter wide and 3 kilometers long yielding 2 ounces of gold per ton. That was by far the richest find yet made in Africa, let alone the Transvaal. And yes, once again a swarm of diggers descended, leading to a famous remark by French Bob, that a carrion crow-like gathering, they came to snatch the spoils from the hands of the toil-worn and the ragged men who had hunted and brought down the prey. Merde! Worse, Moody imposed an extortionate royalty of 50% of the diggers' net profit in exchange for claim rights. A Transvaal judge upheld this royalty, and that was the end for most of the diggers, as Moody then launched his Moody Gold Mining and Exploration Company, which included Theophilus Shepston as a shareholder, which goes to show how nepotism and corruption is a very old South African malaise. All this noise and legal wrangling irritated a party of prospectors from Natal, who wandered off into the deeper recesses of the Kaap Valley. Graham Barber, his cousins Fred and Harry, as well as Edward White and Holden Bowker, a descendant of the famous Bowkers of the Eastern Cape. Rummaging through ravines, cracking open rocks and slopes and verges, sifting the creeks, eventually they stumbled into an isolated drift of the saddle-backed Ngudu Mountain east of Moody's estate. An indigenous forest blanketed the hills here, and looking up, Barber spotted a white thread of quartz high on the cliffside. He climbed it and dislodged a sample, brought it down, crushed it, and panned the bits in a small stream. He was astonished. A thick tail of gold lay in his pan. Barber's jaw must have dropped like a British paratrooper over Tristan da Cunha. This rich strike put the pioneer lode to shame. Here, instead of 2 ounces of gold per ton, it was to serve up 15 ounces of gold per ton. Unlike French Bob, Graham Barber went straight to the local mining commissioner, David Wilson, who was at Davel's Kantoor / Kaapse Hoop, and reported his find. Wilson hurried to the spot and found a gaggle of diggers had already arrived. In a great spectacle, he hauled out a bottle of the potent Holland's Square-Faced Gin and smashed it over the gold-bearing quartz, and then announced, "I name this place Barberton." Graham Barber had been ushered into the annals of history. In 2 months, 1,000 diggers squeezed into the deep ravine, dozens of shacks higgledy-piggledy against the cliffs. 2 years later, it had 10 hotels, 5 churches, 3 newspapers, 2 stock exchanges, a club, a Masonic lodge, and 6 well-built government buildings. It had 1 pub per 15 people, and by 1887 was the home to 4,000 inhabitants and the extended trading centre for 4,000 more. New reefs were discovered. Joe's Luck, Cerre de Pasco, Little Nelly, Cash Down, French Bob's, Maid of the Mist, Vesuvius, Revolver, New Chum, Lost 10 Tribes, Natty's Fortune, Aggie's Husband, Honeybird, and the unfortunate Twice Rejected. But it was Sheba's Reef that remained the most famous, discovered by Yorkshire coal miner Edwin Bray. He suspected the incredible richness had some links to the Queen of Sheba's city of Ophir. He traced the line of the geological formation, the quartz, and so convinced was he of its value that Bray floated a company. He and a syndicate of 14 diggers founded the Sheba Reef Gold Mining Company Limited with a capital of £15,000. They bought crushing equipment and began mining what was known as Bray's Golden Quarry. It was to extract a phenomenal 50,000 ounces of gold. The shareholders received 170% dividend. The £1 shares traded for £105. This was both a blessing and a curse, as Jay Davenport points out. A wave of opportunists flooded Barberton, among them Kimberley's diamond magnates with money to burn, lured to the Kaap Valley in the Eastern Transvaal. Fraud was rampant, as is always the case when speculators pop up. There was no opportunity for commodity broking in gold. That was price fixed, so this group of rich kids from Kimberley began to racketeer in the form of share trading. 4 million shares were registered on the Barberton Stock Exchange. A frenzy became maniacal, such was the lust for a quick buck. Rigging and swindling reached epic proportions. Men in an inexplicable delirium, as English journalist Edward Mathers noted, had foot baths of champagne and lit their cigars with £5 notes. You can't buy class, you know. At Barberton, speculative sharks and spendthrift gamblers only flung away the money the public subscribed as monstrously absurd premiums on shares. The inevitable crash came in 1887. The whole edifice of overinflated shares and overcapitalized companies collapsed in a few days. Thousands of investors now had new toilet paper in the form of their worthless share certificates. But then, like Medusa beckoning over the felt, the drastic moment passed because a true treasure trove had been discovered at a place that was to become known as the Witwatersrand Goldfields. We'll come back to this tale of wealth, power and mining magnate strewn history after a few episodes covering other matters in South Africa between 1881 and 1886. Kimberley had been the incubator for capital. Barberton was its testing ground, but Johannesburg was going to be a master's in business administration in the subject of global financial relevance. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform, and you can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. As the saying Gaelic, slán go bhfá.